Well, good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. You may remember that Ahmed Jamal opened Daniel Ruth's show for many years here on WMNF. And we're going to talk with Daniel Ruth, the columnist at the Tampa Bay Times and Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the hour. We're going to talk about all things going on here in the Tampa Bay area and in Florida. And Daniel Ruth, welcome back to the airwaves of WMNF. How are you?
Well, thank you for having me. That was a nice touch.
Okay, well, it's good to have you back. We miss you. I think all of your fans miss you. And we're going to take some phone calls today, too, and have them interact with you. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Daniel, you were, before you came to MNF, were a longtime host at WFLA Radio. And I want to ask you about the passing of Ted Webb.
I don't know what I can say that we can actually put out over the air. But, no, Teddy, I knew, like so many people who work in media in the greater Tampa Bay area, everybody has had an interaction with Ted Webb. He was a very funny guy and interesting character. I disagreed with his politics, but he was always a great deal of fun to be around and kind of, like so many other people in radio, with you and I the exception, you run into a lot of very eccentric personalities. And
maybe that includes us, too.
And that certainly applied to Teddy. But he certainly was a major figure in Tampa Bay radio history, and I liked him a lot.
Yeah. What I find interesting about Ted Webb is that he was an outspoken conservative on his radio program, and yet, you and I know a lot of liberals, and I, I know a bunch of people from West Tampa who are still, they carry their grandfather's and grandmother's politics with them, and they're still liberal and vote Democrat, and even though they had problems with Ted's politics, they liked Ted as a person.
Oh yeah, he was very funny and very charming, and I think to some extent he really didn't take himself all that seriously, and so he was just an easy person to like, regardless of the politics.
So let's move into some of the news of the day, and the New York Times had more this morning about North Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, a rising star in Republican politics. So he is up to his eyeballs in controversy. New allegations in the New York Times about alleged criminal activity, showing pictures of women he slept with fellow lawmakers on the House floor in Washington, taking ecstasy. This is a guy. Go ahead.
As Gene Kelly says in Singing in the Rain, dignity. Dignity. He, I don't know if you remember, I wrote a column about a month or so ago. It was meant to be tongue-in-cheek. I didn't realize it would be so prescient at the time, suggesting who might be the dumbest member of Congress. And most for many years, that title has reigned with Texas Congressman Louis Gohmert, who is really dumber than a sack of lug nuts. But I said in the column that Matt Gaetz was really nipping at his heels, and he may have actually overtaken Louis Gohmert as the dumbest member of Congress. This business of showing naked pictures of women he slept with to other members, that's just sleazy and day class A under any circumstance. But to do it on the floor of the United States Congress really takes it to a whole new level of smarmy.
The QAnon folks are all upset about sex trafficking. Well, here's an allegation. It hasn't been proven yet that he sex trafficked young girls, at least one 17-year-old. Did you happen to see the interview with him on Fox News the other night with Tucker Carlson?
Yes, I did. I did watch that. And that was it. And afterward, Tucker Carlson said that was one of the most bizarre interviews he'd ever done in his career, which is really saying something. for Tucker Carlson. But yeah, he's just flailing about, I mean, he's been caught doing something. What it is precisely, we may not know just yet, but he certainly has been caught doing something. And it is amazing that the only people who that I'm aware of that have really come out to defend him are this Marjorie Taylor Greene, the QAnon nutball up in Georgia, and Jim Jordan, of all people, who is saddled with his own sexual issue. You know, when he was a coach at Ohio State, you'll remember the story of these wrestlers that came to him and begged him to please do something about the team physician who had been fondling them. And he did nothing. And when it's been brought up, Jordan says, oh, it's not true. I don't know anything about it. And we've had like six, seven, eight of these formal athletes have all come forward and identified Jordan as the coach who refused to lift a finger to help him. And he's the guy that's coming to Matt Gaetz's defense? Really? Really?
The other character that comes up in this, and I don't know how I missed this, and you probably were paying attention to it, but the Seminole County tax collector, Joel Greenberg, he's up to his neck in the allegations of sex trafficking, but when he was a Seminole County tax collector, he engaged in identity theft. He was stealing driver's licenses.
Right.
And the list, that's just the tip of the iceberg for this guy.
He claims to be a big pal of Matt Gaetz, and Gaetz has spent time at his home in Lake Mary, and indeed there is photographic evidence of the two of them together with Roger Stone. Now, there's a trifecta of ethics for you. The three of them all posed together. He took Greenberg on a tour of either the White House or I think it was the White House he got him into. So this is just who I feel sorry for here?
Who?
Don Gaetz, his dad.
Yeah.
I knew Gaetz a little bit when he was in the legislature and he was the Senate president. And by all accounts, Don Gaetz was a partisan Republican, but he was even I think most Democrats would say he was easy to work with and get along with and all that kind of stuff. And he wasn't a fire breathing rabid, a Tea Party type Republican. And here's his son gets elected to Congress, and he just is gone completely off the rails. I don't know if you ever had this conversation with your father. I know I did with mine. I remember when I was 16 years old, I was getting ready. I just got my driver's license, and I was getting ready to go on my first date, take a girl out on a date. And I was getting ready, and my father came into my room, and he said to me, look, he says, I want you to have a good time and all that kind of stuff, but remember two things. Number one, you are responsible for her when you're out and you're driving the car. You're responsible for her welfare. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, and the second thing I want to say to you is never do anything that will tarnish the family name.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that to heart. And you would think that if you had the honor and privilege of being elected to the United States Congress and to go up there and be a public servant, and your father had been a prominent political figure in the state of Florida, that you would have a little extra special sense of responsibility to represent the family name appropriately.
Yeah,
he hasn't done that.
It seems like all the rules are. I mean, this is really a little bit off topic, but Kimberly Guilfoyle. I don't know if you paid attention to her, but the allegations against her that she mistreats staff and walks around nude and naked, and yet she's a champion of the Republican Party, mm-hmm. and yet. You know, I mean, when would you expect QAnon to start talking about this kind of behavior? You think QAnon?
I would be surprised if they did. I mean, QAnon is no different when it comes to hypocrisy than most of these other Republicans of late. So I think you'll notice. Maybe I've missed it because I'm not glued to it every night. But I don't think Sean Hannity has said anything about it. I don't think all these hideous, horrible, dreadful people who are still sitting in for Rush Limbaugh, they're still sitting shiva for Rush Limbaugh, for crying out loud. And I don't either. But they'll be more than happy to go after Hunter Biden.
Yeah, Hunter Biden's still, they're probably still talking about Benghazi on Fox News. I don't watch it enough.
I think they are.
Well, we're talking with Daniel Ruth, and this is WMNF in Tampa. Daniel is the columnist at the Tampa Bay Times and a Pulitzer Prize winner and a one-time host here on MNF. And we're talking about all things state and local politics. And if you've got a comment for Dan, you can send it into the studio here. The address is dj@wmnf.org. David writes, thanks for bringing Dan on the show today. I was curious about his take on Carl Hiaasen retiring from the Miami Herald. Is there anyone who can fill Hiaasen's shoes? And when is Dan going to start writing some novels, award-winning novels?
Oh, you got it. Are you sure that's not my wife writing an email to the station? I've been getting that from her for years. I wrote a little when Hiaasen retired. Colette Bancroft was kind enough to ask me to write a little tribute to Hiaasen. And I said in the it was just a couple sentences long, but I said, retire from what? you're a freaking columnist, for crying out loud. You call that work? I mean, how do you retire from writing a column? I mean, it's in your blood. It's awfully hard to walk away with. And my God, I think he was only writing like one a week anyway. I do one a month for the Times these days. And he couldn't crank out one lousy, stinking column a month. I said, come on, Carl. Nobody retires from this. You know, we retire from work. We retire from jobs. And being a newspaper man in general and a columnist in particular is hardly work. I haven't done an honest day's work in years.
Well, we should say that you started off as a reporter, and you.
I did.
When was your first reporting job?
1973. I started at the Tampa Tribune, and I got the job. I literally BS'd my way into the job since I had literally no experience whatsoever. And Bob Hudson, the managing editor, hired me anyway, and he said, "We'll put you on a desk for 3 months." And then we'll put you on the street for 3 months, and we'll see what you can do. And I hated desk work. I'm not a copy editor. I didn't know what a pica was, for crying out loud. And so I did that for 3 months, and I really wasn't wild about it. And then they put me on the street, and I was the night cops reporter for about 3 years. Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights, I covered weekend cops, and it was all on the job training. And I finally learned how to type. And it's true, actually. And it just so happened that during that year, every major murder that happened in Tampa that year happened on my time.
Wow.
And so I really was able to, I got thrown into the deep end real fast. And I guess I did okay at it because they kept me around.
Well, that's a tough job because you've got to go up to victims' families. How do you do that? How do you go up to a victim's family? That's work.
It is gut-wrenching. I remember I covered the murder of Jonathan Kushner, who was a little boy in the Carrollwood area who was abducted and brutally murdered by these two guys, Gary Tillman and Johnny Paul Witt. And Gilbert Kushner, his father, who was the head of the anthropology department at USF, and his mother was a psychologist, I believe. And I had to spend, Jonathan was missing for about four days, and I spent every day with the Kushners. And it was just, there was this huge search for the boy. And as every day went by, it became increasingly obvious that this was not going to turn out well. And I was there with the Kushners every single day as the search went on. And I'll never forget, finally the body was, they found Jonathan's body. He had been horribly mutilated. And the desk called, I had gone, and the desk called me and said, look, they found the body. And I said, well, okay, where is it? I'll go. And they said, no, we want you to go to the Kushners. And I thought, oh, jeez, I really don't want to do this, you know. And so I drove over to their house in Carrollwood, and it was Halloween night. And I knocked on the door, and you remember Arnie Levine, the criminal defense lawyer?
Yeah.
He was a close friend of the Kushner family, and he answered the door, and he said, they're not talking to the media. And I said, Arnie, I just want to come in and express my condolences to the family. And he said, okay. So I went in and I went up to the Kushners and I expressed my condolences and so forth. And I said, look, if there's anything you want to say, I'll be happy to take it down. If not, I understand. And they started to respond, and I felt this iron grip on my arm from Arnie Levine, and he threw me out of the house. And I said, okay, well, you know, you got to get used to this kind of stuff if you're going to be a reporter. Well, the next day was the funeral, according to Jewish tradition. And we were all over at the synagogue. There was all the press was lined up, and the Kushner family pulled up. And they got out, and Dr. Kushner saw me in the crowd, and he walked over. I'll never forget this. He walked over to me, and he shook my hand, and he said, first of all, I just want to apologize for the way you were treated last night. He said, you meant no harm, and I really appreciated everything you did for the family, and I'm very sorry about what happened. And he said, would you join us with the family in the synagogue to sit with them in the church? And I was just, to this day, this happened almost 50 years ago, and to this day, I'm still just, it was just an unbelievable moment of graciousness on the part of this man and his family who were going through an unimaginable tragedy, and he cared about my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it was an extraordinary moment.
I remember
an extraordinary moment.
I remember Dr. Kushner was a listener to this radio station, and correct me if I'm wrong, did he end up being an opponent of the death penalty even after this horror?
I don't know. His son, David, has written a book called Alligator Candy, and NBC is doing a podcast of it. I was interviewed for it, and I'm in the book. And I don't recall Dr. Kushner's position.
Okay, all right.
He would send me emails now and then. Sometimes about a column I wrote or something. It was oftentimes very funny. And I remember Gary Tillman was coming up for parole. He had done in those days you did 25 to life. And Tillman, the other Witt was eventually executed. And Tillman was coming up for parole, which he was never going to get. And I remember I emailed Dr. Kushner and asked him if he wanted to say anything. And he very, very kindly and very gently declined. And then he died a couple years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a tragic case. You know, speaking of hard work, the Tampa Bay Times, your newspaper, has just published a long two-part series about this lead smelting plant.
Yeah.
In East Tampa, they took three reporters took 18 months to cover the story, and it's about it's a plant that employs 300 people, and apparently, if you work there, you're going to be exposed to high and dangerous levels of lead, and that can result in health problems for you and your family. And this is something that OSHA, the federal regulators, missed, or at least for the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. Has completely ignored. Yet, if it weren't for the paper, we wouldn't know about it.
That's true, and that's one of the real sad, effects of declining newspapers. You know, the Tampa Bay Times publishes online, of course, but publishes a physical paper twice a week, and there are newspapers all over the country that have either closed or had to severely cut back their staffs. And when you do that, not only you don't these sorts of stories are going to be few and far between, and just covering the daily minutia of government starts to evaporate. You know, City Hall and the school board, and the county commission, and the various authorities that we have don't get the coverage that they need to have to ferret out when commissioners and city council people and mayors behave badly.
What do you think the answer is? How do you, because you need that local reporting, how would you solve it?
I wish I was smart enough to give you a really coherent answer to that. I just think you have to, just keep plugging away and hope that maybe things will get a little bit better. And, you know, we see more and more entities more and more entities coming on their nonprofit news groups that are able to go out and get some contributions and to set up news operations that way. And you more than anybody are familiar with the, fundraising,
right?
But that's another model that has cropped up in several markets around the country. I just don't think being totally online really accomplishes the mission of daily journalism.
Yeah, there's something about waking up in the morning and having that physical paper in your hand and being able to scour through all the sections and finding out all sorts of things you never expect.
Well, you know, in my itty bitty teeny tiny corner of the world, out at USF, I teach a class on civic literacy and current events. And all my students have to read the Tampa Bay Times and the New York Times and listen to you and other public radio outlets and watch cable news. And at the end of the semester, I often find out that these kids, and they're bright, they're honors students. They're really smart, brilliant kids, that they were shortchanged by their secondary education when it came to civics and history and so forth. And a number of them turn into news consumers.
Yeah, you get hooked on it after a while.
Yeah, a couple of them have said that they like the idea of feeling smart.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I mean, it's like anytime you read a newspaper, it's almost like an intelligence briefing, whether you read the New York Times or the Tampa Bay Times, because you're getting into the nooks and crannies of your community and really getting a big picture.
I had a student tell me one time that back when we were publishing daily, she took the course and she said at the end of it that she liked to sit in the Marshall Center up at USF with a newspaper in her hands and flip the pages. It made her feel very superior.
Daniel Ruth is our guest, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Dan is a columnist at the Tampa Bay Times, and also he teaches a course at USF, as you heard, and he was a one-time host here on WMNF. We figure we bring him back because so many people miss him. Right now we've got this crisis going on in Tampa Bay. There's this phosphate stack on the south end of the bay that's leaking. And they can't figure out what to do with it because it's got to leak. Otherwise, this earthen dam that surrounds hundreds of millions of gallons of toxic water is just going to like explode and run over US 41 and out into Tampa Bay. But
it's a catastrophe waiting to happen. And I suppose the 2020 hindsight response to this is they never should have let it get that toxic, that dangerous, that big over the decades. I mean, that thing is practically, you can see it from miles and miles away, and it's been growing for a very long time, and no one ever really stopped to think, well, what do we do when we reach an optimum capacity here? And they should have been doing something about this a very long time ago, and I don't know what the answer is. If that thing breaks, the whole community is in deep doo-doo.
Do you think that the phosphate industry, or you have thoughts about the phosphate industry, they got a lot of money. I mean, they take out ads on TV all the time saying what a great industry it is, but, I mean, there's problems with it. The industry can't control this dam from possibly falling apart.
And they talk about how they reclaim land. And, I mean, the commercials are really warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, they look great.
And they look like they're really wonderful corporate citizens, and we all know that that's a crock. But they got great marketing. I bet those commercials probably even win awards sometimes. But the reality is that this is a very environmentally threatening situation. And you would think that the phosphate companies that created it in the first place ought to be responsible for cleaning it up. Maybe under Biden, we now have under Trump, we had an EPA that was populated by, coal lobbyists, and things like that, for crying out loud. And now under Biden, we actually have an EPA that is led by somebody that actually knows how to spell environment and knows how to spell protection. And so maybe, we'll see a firmer hand of the government coming down on these people to take responsibility for the problem that they caused. In the meantime, really all you can really do is cross your fingers and hope for the best.
Yeah. So, Dan, what do you make of two of the leading politicians here in the state, Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis, both wanting to run for president in 2024 at that CPAC convention in Orlando just a few weeks ago? Ron DeSantis, when you take former President Trump out of the picture, Ron DeSantis came in number one, and actually head-to-head with Trump, he did okay. So what do you think of these two guys?
Well, first of all, let's deal with DeSantis first, and then we can move on to the hologram in the Senate that we have there. But Ron DeSantis, that was all name recognition. And I just don't see Ron DeSantis. First of all, he has to get reelected governor in 2022.
Yeah.
Before he starts picking out the drapes in the Oval Office. And that is not necessarily a sure thing. So his handling of COVID and the botched unemployment computer system that we have and a whole litany of things, I hope he draws a viable opponent in 2022, and there are quite a few out there that could take him on, and that could don't forget Jeb Bush was in this position. He was supposed to defeat Lawton Childs in a cakewalk and then go on to run for president, and didn't quite work out that way.
Yeah, the old he coon rose at the light of day, right?
And as for Rick Scott, I mean, the guy has the personality of, you know, a toadstool, for crying out loud. And I don't know, I don't see him, maybe he thinks he can buy the presidency the same way he bought the governorship. And I don't think that that's going to be in the cards for him. And he will, every time he opens his mouth on the campaign, someone is going to remind him of his stewardship of Columbia HCA, which had to pay the largest fine in history for Medicare fraud. And I think, you know, if I was running against him, I would be running commercials reminding people of that. Because it wasn't just Medicare that got ripped off. It was TRICARE that got ripped off as well, which is the veterans insurance program. The Federal Employee Insurance Program. So he has a lot to answer for, and I don't see it.
That's where he made his personal fortune, by looting Medicare. Right.
That's right. He walked away from Columbia when they fired him. He walked away with about $300 million. And that provided the nest egg to pay for his gubernatorial run.
But you talk about, you know, somebody running against DeSantis from the Democratic Party. The Democrats lost the statewide races, at least the Trump versus Biden race last year by 3%. And, you know, the Democrats they had no money at the end of 2020. Now Manny Diaz, the new chair of the party, says that he's found a source of money and that he's solved the debt problem, but they had to lay off staff when he first came in. You know, the Democrats seem hapless too. They don't seem to be, they lost, they did worse in Dade County than they did during the Clinton-Trump election.
But then in 2024, the dynamics will be different too. You know, you'll still have Biden will be the incumbent. And I think if he does it, he's able to accomplish a lot of the things he wants to accomplish. I think he will remain a popular president, and that's very helpful. And if they can recruit in 2022 someone like a Val Demings or perhaps a Dan Gelber or any number of other people who I think would be very viable candidates to take DeSantis on.
Yeah, I think now Nikki Fried puts out a press release every day. So what do you think about the agriculture commissioner running against DeSantis?
I'm all for it. She, you know, she's young, she's articulate, she's attractive, she has statewide name recognition, she's already been elected statewide. It would be a very, a very worthy opponent.
Well, Daniel Ruth is here, and we're talking about all things politics, and this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Dave writes, someone was saying what a great guy Don Gates was, and I saw this in the news today, others that don't know much about the man, but it would be a stretch to say he's an angel, and he sent us something from Health Leaders Media, and I don't really have time to read it, but the headline is, largest U.S. hospice company sued for Medicare fraud. So maybe Gates has some problems with Medicare fraud.
Maybe so. But his son has even bigger problems.
Let's take a few phone calls. Daniel Ruth is here. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Dan in St. Pete. Hey, Dan, you're on the air with Daniel Ruth. What would you like to ask him?
Good morning. I'd like to say that, man, it was so fun when the Trib and the Times were both writing and we could get them the opinion pieces talking about politics and the Rays or the Lens or whatever. And now we're, you know, it's hard to get anything going. But, Daniel, what do you think now about Tropicana Field and the Rays and say, St. Pete politics for mayor?
Well, I think Ken Welsh seems to be the prohibitive front runner in that race at the moment. He's racked up a lot of endorsements, not just from Democrats, but from Republicans as well. So I think you probably have to give the edge to him there. With respect to Tropicana Field, when Mr. Sternberg bought that team, he knew that Tropicana Field was a dump. He knew what he should have known what he was getting into. And I think Rick Kreisman has had every right to hold the team's feet to the fire in terms of honoring the original lease agreement. Then the question becomes, okay, if they don't work something out, will the team leave? And Sternberg's talking about Montreal. Montreal tried having baseball, and it was not an overwhelming success in Montreal. I mean, you may find some other locales, but I don't know, maybe Charlotte or maybe Salt Lake City Las Vegas or someplace like that might be willing to take him. But those communities are going to run into the same problem. Wherever they take that team, he's going to demand that the public build him a stadium. And these stadiums are unbelievably expensive. I think he might be just better off trying to work out a deal to maybe build something on the Tropicana Field footprint and then take the Tropicana and raise it and turn it into some kind of a retail, commercial, residential complex.
All right. Okay.
He's going to be hard-pressed to get the taxpayers of Pinellas or Hillsborough County to pay for this.
Okay, and Dan, we're having some problems with your phone from St. Pete, so we're gonna move on. Dan, what do you think? How much loyalty do you think there'll be if the Rays play both in St. Petersburg and if they split the season and play part of the year in Montreal?
Well, at the moment, that's a bit problematic because they can't go to Canada. Not even the Toronto Blue Jays can go to Canada because of the because of COVID. But once we get past that, and they're splitting their time between Montreal and Tampa, that means you'd have only a third of the team's home game, 25% of the team's home games will be played here, and another 25% in Canada, and then the rest, of course, away games. I don't think that engenders a lot of loyalty. I don't think that engenders a great deal of fan euphoria, which is exactly what you need to support a baseball team. Now, I don't think you're just going to basically, I don't know, split the child in half, and you're not going to get anything.
Are we past the days where the public is willing to pay for a stadium or pay for most of the cost of a stadium?
I think we're past those days in this community, which has been burnt by the Glazers and Hello Sucker Stadium. I think, yes, I think in Hillsborough County, there's no appetite to shoulder the lion's share of building a facility for a multi-millionaire sports owner. I don't think there's much appetite for that at all. And here's the thing. There were numerous locations here in Tampa. Once Kreisman gave them the go-ahead to go find another site, they could have easily accommodated them. And instead, they tried, you remember, Rob, they tried to shoehorn this stupid stadium into a tiny footprint in Ybor City with no parking.
Yeah. And no road access, really.
There's some savvy thinking for you. that location out on Dale Mabry, where they're building Whole Foods now,
mm-hmm.
Just south of the Yankee Stadium complex. I think they could have gotten that property, and it would have easily accommodated a baseball stadium with easy access on and off the interstate, and they weren't interested.
Yeah. I always wonder about the dog track in Sulphur Springs.
Well, that would have been interesting to look at.
I should say that in this morning's Tampa Bay Times, there are six or seven, they've outlined the proposals to redevelop the Tropicana site. And so if mm-hmm. people are interested in that, they can take a look on the website. And I think the city is going to have an unveiling this coming week. Mm-hmm. Let's take some more phone calls, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Robert in Lakeland. Robert, you're on the air with Daniel Ruth.
Hi, Dan. I would like to know what the current newspaper subscribers can do in an effort to stop the dwindling of the printed paper. I subscribe to a daily newspaper in Lakeland and a weekly newspaper that's printed in Mulberry. And I remember when I was growing up, the Tampa Bay Times and the Tampa Tribune were 2 inches thick on Sunday, and my mother used to get both of them. And then the Times bought the Tribune, and now it's printed 2 days a week. It's printed in Lakeland, and I even called the circulation. I said, well, since it's printed in Polk County, do you think that I could at least get a copy of it? And their response was, we never delivered in Polk County. End of story. So narrow-minded. And my second point, quickly, just can you comment on the Florida Bills HB, I think, 35 and SB 402 that want to eliminate the newspaper requirement for public notices? That's going to hurt newspaper revenues and also the public. I wouldn't even have known about those bills if my local newspaper didn't expose it to me with an ad. Thank you. I'll just listen.
All right, Robert, thank you.
Well, he touches upon the very problem that newspapers have, that dwindling advertising revenue. Largely, you know, newspapers failed to react back in when Craigslist came along, which devastated the classified advertising departments of newspapers all over the country, which was a major, significant source of revenue for newspapers. And as newspapers have also steadily declined, you've lost additional national advertising, and fewer auto dealers are buying space, and the department stores, furniture companies, that sort of thing. It's that declining advertising revenue that leads to this gentleman's problem of a thinner newspaper. And if you can figure out a way to boost advertising, the size of the newspaper will grow. It's pretty simple economics. But that's been the bane of the business for a very long time, primarily because, and you know this, I think you and I have even talked about this from time to time, newspapers failed miserably to react to the advent of the Internet. And they did with the exception of just one or two newspapers in the country, newspapers did a very stupid thing. They began to put their publications online, and they gave it away for free. What business model can you sustain for any period of time when you're giving your product away for free? What was the incentive then for people to buy a newspaper if they could go online and get their news off the Internet? And newspapers simply failed to recognize that they were digging their own graves. Only the Wall Street Journal and a paper in Lawrence, Kansas, in the early, early days, had a paywall for their online services. And then it's very difficult years later down the road to say, oh, wait a minute, this thing we were giving you for free, we're not going to charge you for it. Mm-hmm. And that's when people just walk away.
What about these bills that take away legal ads from newspapers?
Oh, that would be I don't know if it would be a death knell, but it would be a serious problem for newspapers because they do rely very much on printing, publicizing legal notices. If you know, and they were by I don't know by law, but I guess by law they had to publish these legal notices to conform to public records. And if you take that away, if you take that revenue away from newspapers, the public notice business, that's just that has to be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, to the Tampa Bay Times and other newspapers which rely on those. On those accounts.
Well, speaking of bills in Tallahassee, let me ask you about the move to limit mail-in voting. They want to limit drop-off boxes. They want to make it harder for people to automatically get a mail-in ballot. They want to stop people from handing out water to folks that are standing in long lines at the polls within 150 feet of the polls. What do you make of what Tallahassee's doing, which mirrors what's going on in a bunch of other states?
Georgia, Arizona, and elsewhere. Rob, my friend, don't you know what this is all about? This is about freedom. This is about freedom and democracy. This is about making a free and fair election. I mean, look, I think we still have a couple weeks left in the Florida legislative session. And do you honestly believe, and you've been around as long as I have, do you honestly believe that Tallahassee is going to allow itself to be out-goobered by Georgia?
this is a goober race?
This will not stand. And I venture to say that by the time we get to the final days of this session, that anti-democracy bill that they're mulling over in Tallahassee will become even more draconian than Georgia. They will figure out a way to make it even harder for people to vote. Maybe you'll have to there'll be a requirement to have to stand in line with your underwear on your head before you can vote. But they're going to come up with something. And this is, just the other day I heard an interview with Joe Gruters, and he was talking about how in 2020, Florida did it right. And he was asked, well, wait a minute, if Florida did it right, why are you doing all this stuff? And all we got was a bunch of humana, humana, humana. Even DeSantis has talked about how flawless our election was in 2020. And yet now they want to turn around and make it even more difficult to vote when they've admitted that Florida's 2020 election went off without a hitch.
They weren't happy with winning 3%. They want more.
No, of course they're not happy. I mean, look, if you make it easier for people, I told you this a week or so ago when we talked about this. When you make it easier to vote, well, what happens? People vote. And when people vote, no good can come from that, especially if you're a Republican, because if you allow people to vote, well, my God, they may not vote for you. This is an intolerable situation. So Tallahassee has to make it, for their own sense of self-survival, they need to make it more difficult and problematic for people to cast a ballot.
Mm. Dan, another bill up there in Tallahassee would add to the penalties for violence that's committed at protests. There's already penalties if you commit violence at a protest. But now they're saying that if somebody in your crowd commits a felony, that everybody in that crowd is going to be subjected to the felony. And I'm thinking with the riot at the Capitol where police officers were killed by bear spray, if you had 40,000 people at the Capitol, thousands of whom went in, would you charge all 40,000 with the murder of the police officer?
I guess in theory, but anyway, a case even closer to home, where the riots we had here in Tampa, up by the university, where that Champs store was burnt down, and the gentleman that set the fire pled guilty this week, and he's facing a substantial 5 to 20 years in federal prison for what he did, and that's appropriate. But other people who may have just been protesting and yelling and screaming and doing whatever, by this standard, they too would be culpable for that act of arson. This is an attempt to suppress dissent. And this country was founded on dissent. By the standards that the Florida legislature is trying to impose, Martin Luther King could have been charged with felony violence for some of his marches and protests.
Yeah, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, I'm sure a few felonies were...
Yes, they should have... Yeah, John Lewis, who had his head cracked open, could have been charged with attacking a police officer, I suppose. It's just every single year, every single legislative session, the Florida legislature looks at the First Amendment and says, how can we make it even more difficult for people to petition their government for redress of grievances? And this is yet another example. We see the legislature every session chipping away at Florida's public records sunshine laws, and this is yet another attempt to undermine the rights of a citizenry to protest peacefully. But sometimes things get out of hand. But if you're not a party to that violence, you shouldn't be held culpable for it.
Daniel Ruth is our guest. Richard writes in. He says, my 10-year-old daughter wants to be a writer. She wants to write fiction. In a past era, I would have pushed her to pursue a Carl Hiaasen-type course, start in journalism and then write fiction on the side. What's your advice for aspiring young writers like my daughter, writes Richard in St. Pete?
There's a famous story about Sinclair Lewis, who was an amazingly curmudgeonly. And he had like one or two friends, and one of them was an English professor at, I think, Princeton. And the friend constantly tried to get Sinclair Lewis to come to his English class and talk to his students. And finally, Sinclair Lewis agreed to show up. So into the classroom walked the great man. And he stood there, and he stood up at a podium, and he said to these students, who wants to be a writer? And a bunch of them raised their hands and waiting for this next droplet of wisdom to come out of Sinclair Lewis. And he looked at them and said, then why the hell aren't you out writing? And turned around and walked out of the room. If you want to be a writer, then go write. And if you write enough and you have a thick enough skin and are able to deal with rejection, sooner or later, you will enjoy some success. And that is just, there's no shortcut to that. My wife just published her first book.
Really?
She's published a children's book. And I'm very, extremely proud of her. And Evening with Yaya, if anybody wants to wants to buy it on Amazon, there's a shameless plug.
What's it called again, the title?
An Evening with Yaya.
Okay. How many rewrites did she do?
Oh, she worked on it a number of times. Went through it several times, and she had to get an illustrator to help her illustrate the book, and that was no small challenge. But it was published last week, and we just had another grandson 2 days ago. So now she's going to have to write a second one, I guess. But
well, congratulations. Let's take some more phone calls. Daniel Ruth is with us, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist at the Tampa Bay Times. Jim in St. Pete is on the line. Jim, your turn. What would you like to ask Dan?
I was just going to say, Dan, you're wonderful. Does he think that David Jolly, who's talking about running for governor, a smart, decent guy, but very conservative, do you think that he could actually lose it for the Democrats or win it for himself?
Oh, I think that's a great question. I think if David Jolly runs, he would run as an independent, and he could cause all sorts of mischief for whomever the Democratic candidate is. So I think somebody needs to have a come to Jesus meeting with him. That if you want to run for something, go run against Charlie Crist again, or run for this, or run for that. But if you try to run for governor, Charlie Crist proved, running for statewide office as an independent is not going to work for you. Charlie Crist was the governor of Florida. He'd been elected to statewide office on a couple of occasions. He's a hell of a campaigner, one of the great retail campaigners we've ever had. But once he left the Republican Party and tried to run as an independent, he didn't have the backing. Didn't have the money. So I would hope that David would stay out of it.
Chain gang, Charlie. The other thing is, can we use the moonscape they created in Central Florida from the phosphate for solar energy instead of using open pasture land and green space?
Well, that's an idea. I'll leave that to you.
Okay.
Jim, thanks a lot. Thank you. We were talking about changes in the election law. There are examples where election, you know, the election fraud is going on here in Florida.
So talk
about that, because the legislature is not addressing this. When you put up a sham candidate, you pay them $44,000 to run, and they have the same last name as one of the other candidates. You talk about David Jolly being a spoiler. When you have a three-way race with two guys having the same last name, and one guy's paid $44,000 just to have his name on the ballot, he doesn't even campaign.
Yeah, never campaigned.
That's election fraud.
And he barely lost.
Yeah, the Democrat who was the incumbent lost by 32 votes or something like that.
I think the good news here is that these folks have been indicted and they got caught, and that is probably the best disinfectant when you're trying to clean up the system, is if people start to pay spending some time in jail and paying a fine. You know, and let's not forget why Frank Arkeels is no longer in the state senate. I mean, he was a sleazebag from the get-go, and from the first day he entered the Florida Senate, and so no one should be surprised that he engaged in this kind of behavior too.
Well, Daniel Ruth is on with us, and let's go to Aditi in Riverview. Aditi, you're on with Daniel Ruth.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're on.
Yes, I can.
Great. I am on the highway heading over to Riverview, so I can. I hope you hear me. And thank you for taking my call. I wanted to let you know that 2 years ago, I moved out of Riverview because I lived 4.3 miles from that phosphate plant.
Oh, my God.
It was horrible. Those fumes, those toxic fumes would come over constantly. You know, it'd be like a wave. And, you know, I put up with that for 9 years. And, you know, I want to know what we can do. I don't understand why the government allows this to happen. That, you know, I even had the Environmental Protection Commission over my house. And I said, you have to come over here and smell this. And I would talk to them and I'd say, why is the government allowing this to happen? And they, you know, his response was, oh, well, we all need fertilizer. And I said, well, isn't that funny? Because, you know, thousands of years, people have been organic farming. Why do we need fertilizer? You know, especially when it's poisoning the environment. It's poisoning the alifaya. I'm heading over to a friend right now who lives on the alifaya. You can look over the river and see this huge toxic mountain. I mean, huge. And I just don't understand it.
Yeah.
Well, it's been there for a long time. I suppose you might also want to take a look at the political contributions the phosphate industry has made, both statewide and federally. Maybe you might find a little bit of an answer there, too.
Aditi,
yeah,
thanks a lot.
It keeps getting bigger.
Yeah. Aditi, I promise we're going to pay more attention to this next week. Aditi, thanks a lot. Dan, we're almost out of time. I've got to ask you, favorite movie. What movie should we see that you've seen that you would recommend?
Let me think. Midnight in Miami?
Yeah, the one about Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali,
and
Sam Cooke.
Recommend Angela. Recent movie.
He's checking with his wife.
No, not The Sound of Metal. One of the worst movies. One of the worst movies I've ever seen.
I'd rather sit through the
English Patient again.
What about Promising Young Woman?
No, my wife's getting out of the
Okay.
Control here.
Hey, Dan, we had so many emails we didn't answer and a bunch of phone calls we didn't answer, so I hope you'll come back.
Anytime.
Daniel Ruth, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's Daniel Ruth, columnist at the Tampa Bay Times. This is WMNF in Tampa. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments Monday. Stay tuned for Janelle Irwin. She's coming up next right here on WMNF in Tampa. And thanks to Cindy Philpott and Frank Knox. They've been our phone producers today. Here's the latest news from NPR. On